Professor Gates, welcome to NAREEM. We really appreciate your time. We have a couple of prepared questions for you, but one of the things I do want to take this opportunity to do is actually to invite all of our members here today to ask your own questions as well. You can use the chat function, or you can actually chat to us, to myself and to Amy Price privately. We can ask your question on your behalf. But Professor Gates, let me just kind of ask one key question that I think we're all is at the top of our mind today as we sit here in 2020, in the year of the George Floyd killing, of Black Lives Matters, of a global pandemic, more than 220,000 deaths in the US, mass unemployment. Is this year different for you as you look to 2020? Do you sense a new momentum for America and that racial equality? We'd love to get your personal perspective.
Well, thank you, Zoe. Thank you for your kind introduction, and thanks for sharing the clip of our latest series. I made the film, let me answer this in a curious way. Sorry. I made this series of all the series that I could have made, because Reconstruction was 12 years of Black freedom, maximum Black freedom, followed by an alt-right rollback. Does that sound familiar? 8 years of a Black president, followed by what? The rise of white supremacy. I remember that I had actual scholars, colleagues at Harvard, writing crazy books that in retrospect sound ludicrous about the end of race, the end of racism, because Barack and Michelle were in the White House, as a friend of mine says, using Black hair care products. That's ridiculous. I tell my students that there are two streams flowing under the floorboards of Western culture. One is anti-Semitism and one is Black racism, anti-Black racism. And they can be dippered up at any time. They are coterminous. Anti-Semitism predates the so-called founding, settling by Europeans in the United States, of course. There were pogroms in the 14th century, if not before. Anti-Black racism is coterminous with the rise of the transatlantic slave trade, which led to 12.5 million Africans being shipped across the Atlantic Ocean between 1501 and 1866. 15% died in the Middle Passage. That means 10.8 million Africans arrived in the New World during that period. And this huge ideological apparatus grew up around the slave trade in order to justify it. So, cut to the Civil War. The only way, none of our African American ancestors ever dreamed in 1700, in 1750 and 1800, even by 1860, that there would actually be a Civil War and that slavery would actually end. But that, of course, is what happened. Between 1861 and 1865, 750,000 Americans were killed. Not to keep the Union together, as the claim is often made, but to end the institution of slavery. No matter how they put it metaphorically, it was about the bottom line. It was about money. Slavery is race and class fused together in one term. And following the Civil War, the Constitution was reinvented. It was Lincoln's new birth of freedom, you know, that famous phrase from the Gettysburg Address. It was the second founding, the ratification of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment. What was the 13th Amendment? Abolished slavery. The Emancipation Proclamation didn't abolish slavery. The 13th Amendment abolished slavery, ratified December 6, 1865. The 14th Amendment established birthright citizenship, due process, and equal protection before the laws. You ever wonder why the United States has birthright citizenship? There are only 33 nations in the world that have birthright citizenship. Why does the United States have birthright citizenship? Because they couldn't figure out how to make our enslaved ancestors citizens after the Dred Scott decision by the Supreme Court in 1857. So they said anyone who'd been born here in the past or would be, you know, who was of color or who would be born here in the future would automatically be citizens. And then finally, in 1870, the ratification of the 15th Amendment, which gave Black men the right to vote. But, and here's the curious thing, in 1867, Black men in the South, in the former Confederacy, got the right to vote through the Reconstruction Amendments. So in 10 of the 11 Confederate states, all the former slaves in the South and the handful of free Black men got the right to vote. And Zoe, guess what happened? 80% of those men registered to vote. Think about that. That's mind-boggling. We don't even have 80% of anybody registered to vote in America today. And most of these men were illiterate because it was illegal to teach an enslaved person to read and write. But they respond, I call it the first freedom song. Those brothers and with their wives and their lovers and their mothers and sisters made them register. You know, there would be meetings at Black churches about registering to vote. And I showed, when I did Congressman John Lewis's family tree for Finding Your Roots, I showed him his great-great-grandfather's registration certificate from Alabama in 1867. You know what he did? He broke down and cried. His head just wham, hit the table. I had to cry. I just did Anita Hill's family tree on Sunday. I showed her her great-great-grandfather's registration drive from July 1867 in Bowie County, Texas. Everybody registered. And even more shockingly, in 1868, they actually voted. 500,000 Black men cast their ballots for Ulysses S. Grant. Well, Grant won the in the Electoral College overwhelmingly, but he only won the popular vote by 300,000 votes. Black men had elected a president. And they did the same thing for Grant in 1872. And between 1870 and 1877, they had sent 16 Black men to Congress, 14 to the House, and 2 to the United States Senate. Then what happened? This was the first manifestation of Black power, because we tend to forget until 1910, 90% of all Black people lived in the South. And more importantly, South Carolina, Mississippi, and Louisiana were majority Black states. And Florida, Alabama, and Georgia were almost majority Black states. This blew the minds of not only the people in the former Confederacy, but the people in the North as well. And so beginning in 1890, starting with Mississippi, each of the former Confederate states had a state constitutional convention which suppressed the vote, which disenfranchised Black men. Look, you can't get rid of a constitutional amendment without another constitutional amendment, right? But they came up with all these ingenious, nefarious ways to keep Black people from voting, including terrorism, lynching, rape, all manifestation of violence. And I'll tell you how effective this was. In 1898, there were 130,000 Black men registered to vote in the state of Louisiana. After its constitutional convention, that number was reduced by, in 1904, precisely to 1,342. They took away the right to vote. They took away all these rights. And that's why we needed the civil rights movement that culminated with the Civil Rights Act of 64 and the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act of 65. Now that is a long-winded way of me giving you the context, you and your colleagues, the context for Reconstruction. And that, and we have never, as you said quite eloquently, we have never adequately dealt with those issues that have been left over. We all thought that when Barack and Michelle were in the White House, that America had turned the corner. And what Barack's election led to what? The election of Donald Trump, not through a cause and effect relationship, but Donald Trump happens to, nobody could believe this was possible, happens to have succeeded Barack Obama as president of the United States. And we see the rise of white supremacy. So,
I hear what you're saying. So I'm hearing that, you know, there's a moment in time. 2020 is an exceptionally unique year where we're all looking at who we are and what we are as a society, you see major challenges then. Do you see this as being different? Do you see this as being something we can grasp and use and push to help finish that revolution?
Well, the reason I gave that long-winded professorial lecture on the history of Reconstruction is to set up, to frame my comments that I am tired of having my heart broken about believing that we are at the end of racism or that this is an inflection point, blah, 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 blah. I think it was Charles Blow, my dear friend in the New York Times, who said, George Floyd's horrific murder, which led to these protests, not only all throughout the United States, but around the world, happened under certain set of circumstances. You had all these kids who were forced to shelter in place with their parents, who would have used any excuse to get out of the house. It was videotaped, and we had two people staring at the camera. This is very important. We had George Floyd staring at the camera, and we had that police officer staring at the camera. And so then we had COVID. So cut to COVID, the mortality rates, we had begun to realize by that time that COVID was colorized. Morbidity rates were higher for people of color, and therefore mortality rates were higher for people of color. And this led to this huge response. Corporations are putting up collectively billions of dollars trying to throw money at this problem. But frankly, and people who know me know that I am a hopelessly optimistic person, but to answer your question honestly, I do not believe that a post-racial America can possibly emerge soon. Racism is our original sin, and it started with slavery. Systemic racism is from structural equality we've inherited from slavery and from the rollback to Reconstruction and Jim Crow. Randy Kennedy, my colleague at the Harvard Law School, published a piece in The Atlantic, and he made a list of these measures of inequality. Now listen to those: life expectancy and health disparity, income differential, median Black household income, 61% of median white household income in 2018. Wealth discrepancy. The net worth of a typical white family is nearly 10 times greater than that of a Black family. $171,000 for a white family versus $17,150 for a Black family. Poor housing. Nobody needs to give you a lecture about that. Limited access to good education and affordable health care. And morbidity and mortality rates from COVID are only our most recent example. Exposure to violent criminality. And then finally, the likelihood of being arrested or incarcerated or killed by the police. I happen to be one of those people who was arrested. And I don't know if your colleagues, you are probably too young to remember. I am the Beer Summit, right? I have been handcuffed and fingerprinted. I have gone to jail. It is not a joke. I don't even make jokes about people spending the night in the slammer anymore. It was a nightmare. And fortunately, I had a friend called Barack Obama who invited the cop and me to the White House for a beer. By the way, that's the last beer I've had because it couldn't be better than that. So how do we fight these things? Okay, consider the following 8 points. One, we raise the minimum wage so every American can have a decent standard of living and a livable income. Next, intense anti-racist training for the police. We have to develop intimate community relations with the police. We should prosecute police officers to the fullest extent. When they shoot Black people, like when they shoot a Black suspect 7 times in the back in front of their children, and when they're found guilty, we should increase training in de-escalation and communication, and we should hold the police to account. Every American should have access to affordable and available healthcare, as President Obama clearly understood. Regardless of their income, this should be a basic human right. I don't know where you're from, Zoe. I gather you're from the UK, right?
I am, yes. So I've learned much about American history, obviously, looking at your show.
You see, I'm a linguistic genius to figure that out. Well, I think you know from my bio, I went to Yale, but then I went to Cambridge and I got my PhD at the University of Cambridge. So
you
I'm
did.
Hopeless Anglophile, but that's only because I fell in love with Indian food while I was over there.
It is our number one food, yes. Yeah.
You got it. And it's much better than anywhere in the United States. Next, job training should be part of our continuing education available to everyone who seeks it. And so should financial literacy. I did Queen Latifah's family tree. Your name is Dana Owens. Her family owned a kind of hardware shop. And she told me something quite fascinating, that her parents, when she was preschool, taught she and her sibs one third, one third, one third. If they got a dollar, 33 cents goes to the government, 33 cents in the savings, and 33 cents they could buy bubble gum and Snickers and Reese cups and potato chips or whatever. Look, if all the professional athletes had practiced one third, one third, one third, they would be zillionaires collectively. We need financial literacy. You're not born understanding how money works. You get people, a lot of times football players, don't get me wrong, I'm a big sports fan, but a lot of time black athletes are passed on because of their size, because of their abilities. They are functioning illiterate sometime. You end up getting, you get $20 million, $10 million goes to the government, and I want to buy my mom my house. So that's another $1 million. And then you got Mookie and Pookie, the cousins, are hustling for $100,000 loan to buy a car wash. And people end up bankrupt. You know, we need financial literacy. For next, affirmative action, which is relevant to your company and every company in America and every institution. I went to Yale. Why? I showed up at Yale September 69. I was one of 96 black kids, 96 men and women. We were all affirmative action products. Why do I say that? Do I think that I was smart enough to get into Yale and the other 95 black people were smart enough? Of course we were. But the class of 66 at Yale had six black men to graduate. So what was their genetic blip in the race? And all of a sudden there are 90 smart black kids in 1969 who didn't exist in 1966. Of course not. You know who was in my class? Sheila Jackson Lee, Congresswoman from Houston. Kurt Schmoke, a college president, now first black mayor of Baltimore. Ben Carson was in my class. You know, I don't pick my friends by their ideology. I would never attack Ben in public. I think that he's wrong. I mean, I would argue with him in his face. But my friends joke that I knew Ben before he breathed all that ether from all that brain surgery at Johns Hopkins. But the most important change would be a massive revolution in the way that we fund public education in this country. We need to bust the dollars from the rich school districts to the poor school districts, so that the amount that we spend, I want everybody to think about this, so that the amount that we spend in this country per child, per school, per district is exactly the same, whether you're living in Harvard Square, I'm in the kitchen of my, I have a beautiful house in Harvard Square. We have fabulous public schools in Cambridge because we have high income. The amount of money spent at, per child at Princeton High School, Palo Alto High School, or Cambridge Rindon-Latin should be the same as it's spent at every public school, in every inner city, on every reservation, in every barrio, in Piedmont, West Virginia. I grew up in a white paper mill town in the hills of West Virginia. The amount of money spent per child should be nationalized. That would be a revolution in this country. And I was in a Zoom presentation on Reconstruction yesterday at Columbia University with Eric Foner and Kimberly Crenshaw, whom you saw in the clip, and Lee Bollinger, the president. And he reminded us that there, under Chief Justice Earl Warren, there was a 5-4 vote to do just that, but it was turned down narrowly by that one vote. We also need to provide hardship pay for talented, motivated teachers to work in the worst performing school districts. Education is the final frontier in dismantling racism, integrating the American mind, and fighting the rise of white supremacy. Two more points. How do we fight violent criminality? Gun control. There's absolutely no excuse for this Congress not to pass reasonable limits on the number of guns a person can own and the type of gun. And then finally, voting, voting, voting. That is the lesson of the rise and fall of Reconstruction. And we as Americans have to fight any manifestation of voter suppression any attempt to suppress our sacred right to vote, any attempt to keep any segment of our population from voting. That's what President Obama warned us about in his eulogy for John Lewis, from closing polling stations to passing voter ID laws to messing with the Postal Service. We can't let that happen. Voting is sacred. It is the key and the catalyst for everything else, for all other rights that follow in the great American Republic. And anyone who tampers with that right to vote is being un-American. So that is a way to answer your question. I do not think, I am sad to say, but I do not think even George Floyd's horrific murder is going to produce a seismic shift in race relations in America. You can't have hundreds of years of slavery followed by a century of Jim Crow and have it disappear overnight, because we are reading Ibram Kendi's How to Be an Anti-Racist. You know, you just can't do that. You can't do it with many of my philanthropic friends from Silicon Valley, and many of my friends in corporations are putting up collectively billions of dollars and the Ford Foundation, the Mellon Foundation. But these programs, it will take decades for us to make progress. So I think in terms of the corporate world, affirmative action, white women have benefited from affirmative action even more than people of color. When I showed up at Yale, there were 250 women admitted to the freshman class for the first time in Yale's history. By 1975, the ratio between men and women at Yale was 50-50. That was amazing. It took us decades to get 12% of the freshman population at Harvard and Yale to equal 12%, which is our percentage of the population. So we need to defend affirmative action, and anybody who mocks affirmative action or says that it allows people who are not qualified to get positions such at your corporation or in institutions such as mine, anybody who says it's a racist or a sexist, and we have to fight them. It is going to take a long time to turn the tide, and we have to do that collectively. I fear that if Donald Trump is reelected, it's going to take even longer to begin to address these problems. Look at the reaction to Barack Obama being in the White House for 8 years. I'm horrified. I mean, I cannot believe. And when Donald Trump refused to renounce white supremacy, it made me sick to my stomach. The only other president in the history of the United States who's refused to renounce white supremacy was Andrew Johnson, the man who followed Abraham Lincoln after his assassination. And he was the person who tried to kill Reconstruction and was impeached by the Republican Congress for his racist attitudes, and they threw him out and replace him with Ulysses S. Grant. Is that a fair response to your question?
I think it is, and I say, I know in terms of affirmative action, we've got so many firms here who are taking steps, and we know this will take time. And I think a lot of what our members are looking for is also advice. And Amy, I would love to bring you in. Amy Price, co-head of Bentall Greenoak, soon to be president of Bentall Greenoak in January. Bentall Greenoak, Professor Gates, just for your background, has actually just introduced a two-thirds target for all new recruits to be diverse candidates' ethnicity or sex. So Amy, I'd love to open it to you. We've got questions coming in. Over to you.
Thank you. Thank you, Amy. Nice. Yeah. That two-third goal sounds pretty good to me.
Well, it's kind of the equivalent of affirmative action, right? And I will say, you know, there's a lot of negativity to that too, that you shouldn't have a target. And I guess our view is you got to have a goal and you got to have accountability. So,
right. Well, good luck. I am not surprised that there'd be pushback to that.
Right. Well, let's talk about, I think what we do want to shift maybe is a little bit, just talk about, let me give you context, right? As Zoe said, you're talking to a group of 50, 60 executive CEOs in the real estate investment management industry.
You mean I'm not talking to
more pictures?
I'm not talking to 10,000 people?
No, you aren't.
I'm
really talking to a smaller, but you know, predominantly white we're way underrepresented in terms of Black and people of color. And at our senior levels, we're also very underrepresented in terms of gender diversity and women. So my question to you, right? Let's just say you wake up tomorrow morning and now you're a CEO of an investment management company like ours. And it's not a diverse place, but you know, it is. There is this kind of awakening, and there's this focus on equity, diversity, and inclusion that there hasn't been. So it may take a while, but you know, what would you do, right? What are those actions? What you gave us 10 or 12 awesome things that needs to happen in the U.S. You know, if you're running a company in corporate America, what do you do?
I would actively recruit, and the creme, we call it the creme de la creme brulee. I would actively recruit at historically Black colleges and universities, the top tier academically, as well as people of color and women at traditional elite universities like Harvard, Yale, et cetera, et cetera. You know, where everybody recruits. I would actively recruit. But then more than that, once you get them to accept a job, how do you keep them in the company? How do you keep them moving up the ladder? And that's even harder often than recruiting. You know why? I was hired to rebuild the Department of African and African American Studies. I have a PhD in English Literature from Cambridge, right? But I do African and African American Studies, particularly African and African American Literature, because that's my PhD. But Harvard brought me here in 1991. It was to rebuild the department. There was one white guy in the department. He was German, and me. So I began to recruit actively. I made a list of people: William Julius Wilson, Cornel West, Evelyn Higginbotham. You might know the name. Well, everybody knows Cornel West. And I went out and I recruited them. And I told them that I had a dream, that I was going to build the dream team. But, and we did. We now have 41 professors in African and African American studies. We have a PhD program in African and in African American studies. And we have the largest African language program in the world, larger even than SOAS, the School of Oriental and African Studies in London, which is a miracle. But how did I pull that off? One reason, a man's name, the dean who hired me, his name was Henry Rosofsky. He lives a couple blocks from me. He's in his 90s. He's Jewish. I call him the godfather. And I had his portrait painted. And it's on the wall. I now run the Hutchins Center, which is funded by Glenn Hutchins, you know, who's a great hedge fund guy. And he's a billionaire and one of my best friends. We have a 23,000 square foot building in the middle of Harvard Square called the Hutchins Center. And when I showed Henry Rosofsky his portrait, he said, the only Jewish man on the walls of a Black Studies research center. And we cracked up. Why did I do that? And why am I telling you this? Because when we were negotiating for me to move from Duke to Harvard, I told him I would come if he did one more thing. And he said, I don't want to offend anybody, but he said, God damn it, we gave you the earth and the moon to move to Cambridge. What more could you want? And I paused and I looked at him and I said, I want you to be my mentor. I said, I'm a Yalie, I'm a Cantabrigian. I don't know anything about Harvard, which is true. I knew nothing about the culture, the sociology, as it were, of Harvard. And everybody before me, FOM was created in 1969 at Harvard, and every chair before me failed. They were a disaster, just speaking objectively. So I said, I need you to teach me how to be successful. And he looked at me, and you know what he said? That is the smartest thing you ever asked for in your life. And every 2 weeks, they announced my appointment on February 1st, 1991 in the New York Times. And every 2 weeks between February 1st and July 1st, they flew me up from Durham to Cambridge. And I had an hour tutorial with the Godfather. And I would ask him questions. He would set up lunches for me to meet people who I would have to deal with, meet people who didn't like me, people who had, thought that African-American studies was total rubbish and should be abolished. you know, people who might even have been racist. He never told me why, he just told me to meet them. And then, so by the time I showed up, I had met all the key players at Harvard, and I had a mentor that I could pick up the phone and call 24/7 whenever I had a problem. You know what? I didn't even send a memo that first year that I didn't send to him first. And then I got smarter. I would call him and say, you know, this is my goal. How do I reach it within the Harvard culture? Instead of trying to pretend I was Albert Einstein or W.E.B. Du Bois. And one time he told me that Harvard Yard was a minefield, and that unless you knew where the mines were buried, you know, you go running through there and you just blow yourself up. And he goes, I'm going to keep you from doing that because I put the mines there. Everybody in corporate America needs a mentor. So when you hire these people, and it includes, I think everybody, white men, white women, everybody needs a mentor in any organizational structure. But I think it's particularly true for women and for people of color. So I think that there should be a mentor arrangement. Sometimes chemistries, you just know that somebody likes you and you could seek them out as a mentor. Other times, and the chemistry's off. It wouldn't be a good idea for you to be talking to that person. But I think insofar as you could formalize it, mm-hmm. I think that would be good. It'd be good for the company and it would be good for you. All of us have doubts. All of us have fears, but we often project them into the world as sexism or racism or, you know, whatever. And, you know, they don't like me because I'm from West Virginia. I mean, you know, I've heard every kind of insecurity. My father used to say the two kind of people in the world, those who are scared and just get up and get on with it, and those who are scared would just stay in bed. Everybody's scared. So you have to learn that. And once you learn that, that makes you feel more self-confident. I always know the students in one of my lectures who have not done the assignment. You know, I look at them, I say, have you read the book? And what you should say is, no, I haven't read the book. Or when you're in a conversation, this is gonna sound like a small thing, but if you're in a conversation with your colleagues and somebody mentions, say, Ibram Kendi, and you never heard of him, don't just nod your head and act like you heard. Say, who is that? That is one of the biggest power moves that I teach my students and my mentors at Yale taught me. It shows security. No, I don't know what that word means. And I don't have time to look it up. So tell me, what does this mean? So all these kind of things that you have to learn. And these are just small little things that bit by bit, block by block, build up self-confidence. Just saying, teach me. I don't know the answer to this. I don't know what you're talking about. Help me become better. Because everybody you hire is going to be smart enough to do it. But the question is if they'll be mentored well enough. Well, in addition, are they self-motivators? But will they be self-motivators and mentored sufficiently to succeed in your company? Because what you don't want to do is have that two-third diversity goal and then have people come and self-immolate, to burn up, you know, to burn out. You can't let that happen, because then other forces will say, see that? We wasted all that money bringing all these people here. So recruitment is crucial, but retention is just as important.
Okay. And I think, Tiffany, if you're on and you want to jump in here, you had a question, I think, related to this and this concept of fear and how we manage it for some of our people. Are you there?
I am, and I didn't know that Stina and Zoe were going to play that clip, but when they asked me if I had a question for you, Dr. Gates, I joked with them, yes, ask him if he can solve my grandmother's grandfather's murder. And I know I shouldn't joke about murder, but the idea was that she was born in 1918, 2 years before women had the right to vote in the United States. And she just ingrained in us that her grandfather was a very successful Polish merchant who was arrested in Russia and executed in a Russian prison. So just with that context, it's very deep within me that I worry about these topics. We have a 10-person management committee. we had two diverse people on that committee. Now we're saying we're gonna go for a 50-50 split. And conversations like this are happening in many of our firms. So as that's happening, we have to acknowledge that that creates a displacement of people who have been on a long career path thinking they were, who saw themselves getting those slots. And now instead of thinking they had 10 open slots, now they're thinking they have five because they're not a diverse candidate. So how do we as executives and leaders help get ahead of that reckoning that we've been talking about this whole conversation?
Well, you know, it's very interesting. I can't say who, but I have a, you know, all my friends, I'm the only one dumb enough to go into the academy and live a life of poverty, right? All my friends went to law school or business school and they're doing well. And I have a lot of white friends, a lot of black friends. And a couple of my white friends have said, I mean, it's people like fabulously wealthy. And they have said, you know, I should have been elected the chair of the board. And I mean, this conversation actually has happened to me recently. And they call me and they say, I'm really pissed off about it because it's going to be a person of color. And I have to basically mentor them to do the job. He said, that makes me angry. That hurts my feelings. I want to break down and cry. I have waited. I have wanted to be the chair of the board. And now I can't do it because we're in this Black Lives Matter. And we talk it out. And I would encourage people whose feelings are hurt legitimately, you know, to talk it out and not be labeled as a racist because they feel that way. That's human. That's a human thing. They can either stay, they can wrap their head around why this is happening, they can help facilitate it, or they can move on to another job. I mean, what I would hope is that they would help the people being brought in. They would understand the historical reasons for that. We have to draw a line somewhere, and someone has to suffer. And by suffer, I mean, look, 96 Black people entering Yale, 90 more than 3 years before, that meant 90 white guys didn't get in. 250 women were admitted to the freshman class in 69. That meant 250 men didn't get in. You know, that's just the way it is. You know, there's only so much water this glass can hold. That's the way it's gotta be. But I think creating a forum where people can voice these things without being mocked or called racist would be very, 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 very important. Your first question though, I didn't take lightly at all. I, as you know, finding your roots is that's my baby. And if no one in this Zoom meeting has heard of it, I want you to go home and Google it, you know, go watch it. We're the number one show on PBS. And when I started it, we only did Black people. And you'll be amused by this. I did Oprah and Quincy. And, you know, I got up in the middle of the night, frankly, to go to the bathroom, and I got the idea. And tears rolled down my face because I was going to get 8 prominent African Americans that would trace their family tree and do their DNA and find out what ethnic group they were from in Africa. And I burst out crying. I've been interested in my own genealogy since I was 9 years old. And then with the new DNA, this is back in 2000, Black geneticists reached out to me and said they could do for an African-American what Alex Haley claimed that he did for himself. They could do it in a test tube in a lab. And they used me as a guinea pig. And at that time they had to take your blood. Instead, now you just swab your cheek or spit, right? So anyway, a couple of years later, I got this idea. And I reached out to Quincy Jones and then to Oprah, and they did it. And I had to raise $6 million and nobody knew if I could do it. So I had to go pitch all these companies and they would say, can you do it? I go, yes, I can do it. And it aired and it boom, went crazy. And then so many people watched. PBS asked me to do a sequel. And this time PBS was giving me some money and sponsors were lining up. And I got Morgan Freeman. Anybody who plays the president and God, you got to do his family tree, right? And his DNA. And I did Tina Turner because I love Tina Turner. And I did Chris Rock, et cetera, et cetera. So why am I telling you this? Big hit. I get a letter from a lady who says she's of Russian Jewish ancestry. Dear Professor Gates, I've always admired your stance on multiculturalism and cultural diversity, but having watched what we then called African-American lives, I've decided you're a big fat racist because you don't do white people. How come you don't do Jewish people? How come you don't do, and I went, oh my God. So I called my corporate rep at Coca-Cola, a black woman named Ingrid Saunders Jones. This is, I swear to God, this is true. So I called her cell phone. She picked up the phone. I didn't know that she was in a meeting with all these other executives. She was the only black person in the room. I go, Ingrid, this Jewish lady just wrote to me and said, I'm a racist. She goes, what? She said, hold the line. And she walked down the corridor and I thought the phone call had dropped. I kept saying, Ingrid, Ingrid, Ingrid. And I started to hang up. And she was, I go, Ingrid, are you there? And just before I hung up, she goes, Skip, it's me, I'm whispering. I was with all these white people. I needed to go down the hall. And I go, okay, Ingrid, what's the answer? And she goes, I only have one thing to say to you. I said, what? I said, well, can I do white people? And she goes, the only thing I want to say is there are a lot more white people drinking Coke than black people. So we expanded the brand. And now we do the family trees of a lot of people like you whose ancestors were Jewish and from the Pale of Settlement, or Eastern European Ashkenazi Jews. And doing the genealogy of Ashkenazi Jews is as hard as doing black people back into slavery. But we've become really expert in it. I've invested some money myself into digitizing records. So if you want to write to me offline, I will connect you with our genealogical team, and they have their own company, and they'll tell you what happened probably to your great grandmother, whoever it was that you said. These are solvable mysteries now that more and more records have been digitized. I think everybody should have their DNA tested and everybody should do your family tree, but that's because I think it builds self-confidence. I think it enhances your self-image. I think that it strengthens you to know that you are, you're standing on the shoulders of your ancestors. And after all of our ancestors back 300 years deposited some DNA in our genome. So we are walking family trees. And I think that tricks like that are self-empowering. And by trick, I mean, when you think, I'm representing my family. These are tools that we all need to overcome our fears in the corporate world. We all need to bolster our self-confidence because we all are insecure. We all are afraid of failing. We're all afraid of letting down our family. And so these are just simple lessons in human psychology that we need to make available to the people that we hire so that they can not only do well, but move upward in your corporate structure.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. And Tiffany, obviously, we can absolutely connect you in terms of the genealogy there. I do want to pick up on one point and bring in David Donato. Professor Gates, you obviously talked about financial literacy. David, I know you've got a big question on this one. So David, why don't you fire away?
Yeah, I think literacy is certainly a part of it, but financial access, I'm sure you could lecture on that all day, but from redlining and FDR's, Housing Act to access to loans, to just even having a banking relationship. It's one thing knowing how to save the dollars you've got, but investing. And most people's beginning of wealth for most families is the house they lived in. And being shut out of that for so long. I came from a lower middle class background, but at least my family owned our home. And that equity was what helped pay my way to go to Dartmouth. And it shuts you out of so much to not even have that cushion of equity or access to the beginnings of wealth and the trickle down to today. I mean, how do you quantify it and how do you rectify it now? I mean, it's the 17,000 versus 170,000, right?
Well, you can't wave a magic wand and rectify it, right? There are lots of my friends write about reparations, and we all read Ta-Nehisi Coates's fabulous long essay in The Atlantic on reparations. But what form will reparations take? And how long will it take? Again, not to sound like a wet blanket, but it's going to take decades to address these problems. The most radical thing that can happen is the reform of our public education system. That is the most radical. That is how you're, where are your ancestors from?
Italy.
Italy. And when they came at the turn of the century, probably, we had great public schools and they went to public schools. You know, my parents never referred to any of my teachers by their first name. Now, I know that might sound corny and irrelevant to young people, but it's very important. It's just a sign of the respect that public school teachers had when I was growing up. Well, that is gone. So that we have to reform our public school and we have to, public schools, and we have to believe that we're in this for the long haul. There's not gonna be any, no Congress, no president. Look, Barack Obama didn't endorse reparations. There's not gonna be anybody who writes some check that gives it to all Black people who are descended from people who were enslaved. It's just not gonna happen. Should it happen? Maybe it should happen. Is it gonna happen? No. I built my career on being a realist. I don't think that that's gonna happen. But slowly, I'll give you an example about slowly. David Evans was the Black person in the Harvard admissions office. And he just retired this July after 50 years. Now, David Evans in 1969 had a master's degree in engineering from Princeton, an African-American man. How rare was that? Think about that. And was working for the Saturn program for IBM in Alabama. And Harvard announced that they were trying to recruit more qualified Black kids back in 69. Same time, I'm showing up to go to Yale. He took a leave of absence and took a job for 1 year in the admissions office at Harvard to help them. He traveled around the country trying to find Black kids smart enough to make it at Harvard, because he knew that if they let in a bunch of Black kids and they flunked out, people would say, see that? They're not ready. And let's get back to letting six in and not, you know, however many they were letting in. Well, David gave us a report that over 50 years, he personally admitted over 6,000 African-American men and women to Harvard College. That's 50 years, man, 50 years. But those people he let in graduated. You know, Harvard's got this incredible, like, I don't know what it is, you can Google it, so fact check me, but it's over 95% of the people we let in graduate. It might even be 99%. And it's true for the Black kids as well. And those people over the last 50 years have gone on into the corporate world and the legal world and the academe and the medical world. But it took 50 years to get 6,000 people in. I'm only giving that one example to say, we have to be long distance runners. If you think that you can throw money at this, the legacies of anti-Black racism, slavery, and Jim Crow, and fix it overnight, you could forget it. But I tell you, in addition to revolutionizing public school education, I think within the Black community, our churches, and I preach about the preach, it's a bad pun, but I think that our Sunday schools should teach financial literacy and Black history, as well as about, you know, Moses and Jesus and what, you know, heaven and, you know, whatever else. And I think that our mosques should do the same thing. Just like Hebrew school. A lot of my Jewish friends, tell you something funny. A lot of my Jewish friends when I was at Yale used to talk about Hebrew school being the worst thing in the world. On Saturday, they had to go to Hebrew school and learn Hebrew and learn about their own tradition. And they were never going to inflict that on anybody. So one of my good friends, it went to Harvard, and then he was at Cambridge with me, and then came back and went to Harvard Law School. I'll tell you his name. His name is Willie Forbath. He's a very distinguished professor of law at the University of Texas. Cut to like 15 years after we're having this discussion in Cambridge, and Willie calls me and said his wife had a baby. And I go, great, what's the baby's name? He said, Moses. I think that we need our version of Hebrew school. I have a Japanese producer. She's half Norwegian, half Japanese. She sends her two kids to Japanese school on Saturday. We need our Sunday schools to be turned into financial literacy, computer schools, Black history schools, just like other ethnic groups, just like Jewish people have done, like Asians have done. We have to do that. We have to do this collectively and over time, we could begin to address the wealth gap. But it's not going to happen overnight. But gestures like your company with this two-third diversity goal, if that is done throughout the corporate world, and nobody's going to do two-thirds. I mean, that's radical, right? And it's amazing, and I praise you for it. But if we get more and more, if the George Floyd moment can lead to more diversity across, more diversity targets or goals, you know, we can't have quotas, but more diversity targets and goals, then slowly, incrementally, we could begin to address things like the wealth gap, affect the, speak to the morbidity rates, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Because you think about it, it's all a function of education. It is all a function of education and believing that the system will reward you if you work hard enough. Why work hard if the system is not going to reward you, right? Why work hard if a high school is a place of violence where people beat each other up and shoot each other? So for me, maybe because I'm an educator, that's where it all starts and stops, with pre-K education. My kids started school when they were two, Montessori school, and they both got great education. I was introducing Ibram Kendi for a Du Bois lecture. We had 700 people online, and my granddaughter, who's five, came in the back door right there in her mask with two of her friends from K school, and they were waving the 700 people in. She's been in school for 3 years. I know, because I paid for it. We have to revolutionize access to quality education. I wish I could say, and you could talk, there are a lot of activists who are Black and a lot of my colleagues who would answer the question differently and say, we need reparations. We need to give everybody money. You know, we need to, I believe in reparations, but it's called affirmative action. I believe in reparations, it's called school reform. I believe in reparations, it's called affordable, available healthcare. That's what, and that will cost trillions of dollars if we did all of that. That's the form that I think reparations should take.
Terrific. Well, that's an impactful note to end on. I think we're respectful of everyone's time. So I want to thank you for, I think, both a dose of realism, but also inspiration. So thank you for combining the two.
Thank you.
We're very honored to have you. You have celebrity status in my house, by the way. So, you know.
Thank you.
Yeah. So my kids were very much in awe that I was going to have the opportunity to have you on my screen today. So.
Well, you tell them I gave them their mother a shout out. How about that? Well, thank you. You know, you all, I didn't know anything about you before you reached out. You're an interesting group of people, I have to say. And you all are crazy, you know, two-thirds diversity. You all wild, you revolutionary. So go ahead. If I can be an advisor in any way, if I can consult, I'd be happy to. And I promise all the answers to my questions won't be 50 minutes long, but that's how professors are programmed.
Doctor, we get it. Listen,
careful what you wish for.
You got it. All right, God bless. Stay safe. I just filled out my ballot today.
Yes.
My secretary will pick it up tomorrow. It will be mailed. I voted for all Republican Donald Trump. You know, I'm
sorry. You're losing your credibility now.
Yeah. They don't, you know, and I looked at the ballot. It's so funny. Massachusetts, right? For every position, the Democrat was listed first and the Republican. I think they even had independents and other before the Republicans were listed. So I know how it's going to go in Massachusetts, but let's just hope it goes right. And let's hope our country makes a peaceful transition of power, no matter what. So.
Well said.
Thank you.
Thank you. Very much appreciated.
Professor Gates, thank you very much. We really appreciate your time. And thank you very much to everyone, to Amy, to Ryan, to absolutely everyone, and especially obviously our planning committee for the executive officer meeting. Thank you for staying. We know we've run over, Professor Gates. We know we've run over for you, but thank you very much for your time. I think there was so many words of advice. We will share all the screens. We will share the presentations, but really looking forward to the next gathering and learning connection for NAREIM. Professor Gates, wishing you all the best. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Thank Bye-bye. You. God bless.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
And with that, we will wish you all the best. Take care, everybody.